This episode of the Commerce Marketer Podcast is brought to you by Bronto Software, the leading email provider to the global internet retailer 1000. For more ideas on how to improve your marketing automation and to take your email to the next level, visit www.bronto.com/resources. Do you typically buy your flour, beans, or my new personal favorite, lentils, online or in a grocery store? If you're like me, it's mostly grocery store driven. When it comes to which brand to choose, you might stand in the aisle, look at 10 different brands, including store brands, which are all now sitting side by side. Which one do you choose and why? Welcome to the Commerce Marketer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Zachos, recording from Sweet World in sunny Las Vegas. Today, I'm going to speak with one omnichannel retailer whose products can be found in virtually any grocery store about how they use different marketing strategies, from email marketing, social, and content marketing, to drive product awareness and keep engagement high, and of course, drive sales. And we'll talk about the challenges of driving online sales for products traditionally purchased in brick and mortar stores. To join me in the conversation today, I welcome to the show from Bob's Red Mill, Cassidy Stockton and Kevin Irish. Cassidy, Kevin.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
No problem. So we're debating right now whether Kevin should go to a hockey game tonight. So
2 out of 3 think he should go.
All right. I'm going.
So guys, while we assume most people, if not everyone, knows who Bob's Red Mill is, let's not assume. Can you guys just real quick give a background about who the company is, what makes you guys stand out from your competition, and kind of who your customer is?
Sure. Yeah, we're a flour manufacturer primarily, but we have about 400 different SKUs. We're based out of Portland, Oregon, and we specialize in whole grains and baking ingredients kind of for every meal of the day. So something for breakfast, dinner, lunch, snacks. We produce our products on stone mills, so it's a slower process than traditional mills, which kind of gives us something special. We were founded by Bob Moore in 1978 and have since grown to be an international brand and
real early adopter to gluten-free and lifestyle diets catering to gluten-free, organic, whole grain.
And now delving into paleo and keto and all the different types of diets. What I like about the brand is that we have something for everybody, no matter what type of diet you follow. But wholesome ingredients, a lot of becoming certified, non-GMO verified. I mean, just really a lot of care goes into the products. We're an employee-owned company, so everybody's really vested in where we're going as a company. Bob just turned 90, still there every single day in the office.
Is he really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
If he's not there, he's in China, Canada, trade shows like this.
Yeah, he loves getting out to meet people face to face.
Me and my wife always talk about this when we see someone invested like that. And they're like, how great is it to love your job that much where you still want to do it when you're 90?
Yeah, you know,
much less 70. But
it's infectious, his passion for the brand and for what we do there.
Well, that's great. I mean, I'm sure from an employee standpoint, you look at that and you feel inspired. Mm-hmm. You know, I would assume so at that point. That's really cool. How about you guys independent? You guys are the whole marketing department, right?
We're more like the digital space. I've been at Bob's for 14 years, and I really helped us start a social program at Bob's. I started the influencer program, doing the email marketing solo for a long time. It was a really fledgling program at that time, but I've really developed from the space has changed a lot in the 10 years plus that I've been doing it, but from starting basics like a Facebook page and a blog and moving into a full, pretty robust influencer program with different social components. And Kevin and I manage our digital marketing. I do more of the softer parts, the writing, the designing, and that type, where Kevin does all the hard programmatic pieces.
More the data stuff. Mm-hmm. I was brought on to Bob's now 4 years ago. I was the first anything with e-commerce in the title.
Okay.
And my first day, I was handed a printout of our accounts, and I noticed that bobsredmill.com was not considered a sales account. And literally from day one, I was like, that doesn't quite make sense. So I stayed in the role, the sales role, which did not include bobsredmill.com. And about 2 years ago, my position was altered. I was brought onto the marketing team because bobsredmill.com is seen as a marketing entity.
Okay.
So I was the first e-commerce as well as first digital.
How do you like that pivot?
Good. I do like it. The sales aspect was keeping our major e-commerce retailers happy.
Okay.
A lot of CSV uploads, with Amazon, Vitacost. That's what we define as an e-commerce sales channel. Being part of the marketing team and in charge of bobsrental.com, it's a lot more creativity. We run holiday contests, promos. We have a coloring contest up right now. So we're able to do more outside of the box than just make sure your A+ detail pages are up to date with the right photos.
Yeah, before Kevin came on board, our email marketing program was virtually non-existent. I mean, I think I had actually at that point stopped sending them out, period. I didn't have time for it, overworked with so many different other avenues. And it wasn't ever a goal to generate revenue through the site.
You consider the online, which is really an online store, but there's a whole lot more to it. And we'll talk about that today. We were talking before we started recording about, I came across recipes the other day, and I made one this weekend. I was like, man, that sounds good. There's so much more to it, but you consider that a marketing play. It certainly can drive revenue, and I'm sure does drive revenue for you as well. Your products are in stores all over the country. I'm assuming the online portion is probably just a smaller subset of that, but are you guys comfortable giving any sort of direction to the audience about our online generates XYZ percent of revenue or something like that?
Well, what do you call online? Is it, do you count a sale on Amazon and Vitacost? That would vary it greatly. But if you look at our combined online, counting both Amazon and all e-commerce channels, as well as bobsrental.com, it's less than 10%.
Okay.
But in that ballpark.
Which is probably about right. Just massive amount of grocery stores and retailers out there. So I first use a Bob's product, and 10 years ago, 11 years ago maybe. And it was actually, you mentioned before, but the gluten-free thing. So I met my now wife, and she started eating gluten-free. So we were looking for flours and things like that, and Bob's was there. So, you know, I've been a personal customer for a long time. You guys have products which are available, and I kind of led to it poorly in the intro that I go to the grocery store, whether it's Whole Foods or, you know, a Kroger or whatever it might be, and I'm looking at flour, beans, whatever it might be, lentils for my kids listening. There's a lot to how to drive sales there. So it kind of ties to the online side where you want to use it for marketing, and we'll get into some of the content marketing things. But how do you guys stay top of mind when you have just this immense amount of competition there, for especially for people that might not be looking online for flowers or doing research and different things?
We deploy a lot of different strategies to stay top of mind. I mean, pretty much all of the like mainstream marketing avenues, print, digital, outdoor, a bit of TV. But we really focus on different markets throughout the years of really trying to go deep on different markets that perform really well for us. You know, we do a lot in Portland where we're based, trying to just be in front of people. So I think digital ads are one of the most effective ways we do that. Just being where people are searching, popping up in social or wherever they happen to be for any type of like-minded targeting that we're doing.
That's cool. I want to talk about the email program a little bit. And you mentioned something a minute ago. You're like, hey, we didn't consider it a revenue driving channel before. And at one point you stopped sending messages, presumably because just time constraints. The emails before, were they more exactly the content marketing type stuff? Was it more like recipes and engagement type stuff?
You know, 5 years ago, it was a lot of batch and blast, a sale, 10% off a specific set of SKUs. And now we've evolved into a much more sophisticated strategy. We do still send out massive emails where we're doing sales around, for instance, right now, the spring baking is one of our top times of the year. People buy a lot of baking ingredients for Easter, Passover, that kind of holiday, Mother's Day. And so it's really shifted. We do the sale emails, and we've evolved into more some segmented specials and browse recovery type stuff. And we do a recipe email that goes out.
Weekly. We're lucky in a way that people would shop us for a gluten-free lifestyle. And so part of our welcome series, we ask basically essentially what products interest you, why are you using the site? And we're able to segment that with the Bronto product of the recommended products.
The recommendations.
Yeah. So we, within our Magento backend, every product is flagged as this is a gluten-free, this is organic, and this is paleo-friendly. And that data gets passed to Bronto, and we have built the recommendations based on what they tell us in their welcome two or three.
So with subsequent emails that go out then, if I'm understanding correctly, it might still, is it still a batch and blast type email, but with recommendations there, or do you guys do any more slicing and dicing of that?
We do both. We batch and blast, like we currently have a sale going on now. We just send a sale announcement, but it's the automated workflows is where we infuse that product specific data based on the customer data.
Makes sense. Do you guys view email as revenue driving opportunity? Is it strictly about engagement? How do you guys approach your email program?
All of the above. If we launch a 20% off sale, that's really all we're telling people. And then we clearly see click-throughs and revenue from that. But we also use email for new product announcements. We know that's a large reason that people visit the sites, our site. We launched a weekly recipe email last year and great engagement there. And we've utilized the browse recovery and cart recovery tools, which is a very revenue-leaning objective.
So you guys went from 5 years ago, you mentioned, email just kind of, we got bigger fish to fry. Mm-hmm. So now you mentioned welcome series, you mentioned using product recommendations and messages, mentioned cart abandonment, mentioned browse abandonment. So that's a pretty healthy list of automated lifecycle messages. And I mean, a lot of retailers that could certainly benefit from browse recovery do not use browse recovery yet. And that's pretty impressive of a growth. When was the first lifecycle message you guys put in? Like, I'm assuming it was probably a welcome or something, but when did you start automating messages? A couple of years?
2 years ago. We started the welcome series 3 years ago.
We've been with Bronto.
Okay.
And we've just been, every year we set a goal, specific amount of automated messages and segments to build different types of emails that we want to introduce. Last year we had a birthday email that we wanted to get going. And so that's now running and functional. Recently we did just a customer survey to see if people were using the emails the way that we wanted them to, see if there was any other opportunities to add automation to those. It was really interesting.
So that's interesting to me that you set goals every year for, hey, we want to do XYZ of either new automation or just add a message here. How do you guys come to the determination for this is how many we want to do or these are the types we should do? Is it just two of you guys talking internally? Are you pulling people from other departments being like, hey, we should do this? Or,
you know, some of it is we work with our digital agency about other opportunities that we could, that we're missing out on, ways people are using the site that we might be able to work with. And then otherwise, the two of us just sit down and brainstorm what we want to do. Then we present them to the marketing director and the vice president of marketing and get approval on that. Then we start building it out and working on them, setting a timeline against it.
And it's the two of you doing these things. So you have other duties in your job other than it's just this too, right? Which is pretty typical for most email departments, regardless of the type of products you sell. How do you guys balance getting things done? Because that's, you talk to people at the conference here, you probably talked to them in years past, whatever conference, or just, you know, colleagues or friends that you have in the space. That's always a challenge. Well, it's only me and one other person. I don't have time to do these things yet. You found a way to make the time to get them done. How'd you guys get it done? What is your process for working? Do you have like 2 week check-ins and are you making progress?
Actually, we check in once a week on the digital stuff. And This is just part of it. Our offices are next to each other. We talk to each other all day, every day, basically talking about different pieces. Personally, with my workflow and the duties that I have, email tends to be something I focus on a few times a week for a few hours as I can. And then other stuff, that's how I batch my work in general.
We're lucky we're supported with a graphics department. So we've got copywriters and graphics. We delegate those responsibilities out and we give them a good enough heads up, a couple of weeks. And for us, for a sales related email, we pass it. We have an in-house customer service department. They need a heads up because notoriously we send out an email. Some people don't understand how to input the code, so they need to be on board. We don't want to run out of stock, so they up order to make sure we're in stock. Bronto is a powerful tool. So Cassidy mentioned that I'm more of the back end. So the segmentation, the lists and the the segments are very powerful. Within 5 minutes of work, I can have 2,000 contacts who spent between $200 and $300 in the last 4 months, which is very powerful for us.
Do you guys have plans in place? And it's okay if not, because I'm just going to jump to a bunch of conclusions and steer you down wrong directions here. But do you guys have plans in place to do exactly what you talk about, Kevin? We could do the segment of these customers who have purchased between X and Y dollar figures, and then build unique lifecycle messaging out for like that segment. So when they make a purchase and they fall between this range, or whether it's the second or third purchase, whatever, they get a different series of messages or anything. Is that kind of on the long-term roadmap for you guys, or is it more, we do these segments for individual campaigns to try to do XYZ?
It's actually our short-term roadmap. it is our current to-do is based on exactly what you just described. Cassidy said we put these goals of what we want to see the platform be able to do for us, and that's our current goal.
We talk about all these different lifecycle messages. Welcome series, debatable. It's half revenue, half engagement. My guess is that probably your welcome message probably converts fairly well because of user. Yeah, there you go. But like browse abandonment, cart abandonment, these are revenue driving opportunities, right? You're trying to secure a sale, or you're trying to capitalize upon consumer intent. Which ones do you guys find to be the most effective of the group from a revenue standpoint? And then are there any that, any kind of surprises that maybe you learn from any of the messages as well?
Yeah, we're lucky that our product is consumable. So if you're a customer once, you're very likely a customer more than once. So we have looked at the data to see when that churn, 45 days for us. Okay. So we have automation, a workflow running that if you place an order, but not in the last 45 days, then we a win back. And also, although we have 400 products, there's obviously some top products, our almond flour, our muesli, our gluten-free flour, and a handful of others that are the majority of our sales, both online and in stores.
Okay.
So we have made specific workflows for those. If you placed an order 8 days later, need inspiration on your gluten-free flour, check out these recipes, these blog posts. Oh, and maybe you need to reorder again.
Yeah, some of our products, it's really tricky to figure out the actual life cycle because people purchase them for so many different things. Like some users might purchase almond flour and use the whole bag in one recipe, while others might be adding a couple tablespoons to stuff. So from our perspective, the data we have, it's kind of hard to figure out exactly what that is. So that's where we veered more towards the let's give them inspiration to purchase and to what to do with that bag of flour. And then they go through, they can get the different messages depending on what they purchased, but they won't get the same message twice. Like if you bought almond flour again, you aren't going to get the same recipe email.
You guys came into this room. We weren't recording. We were talking about kids and hockey games, which Kevin's going to later. You know, lentils, we're just kind of BSing. And we were talking about the podcast. And I said, everyone has a story to tell. And you guys are very kind of dismissive of your own work. If I could say that in like a flattering way, but you're like, oh, we're just little old Bob. You guys have a lot of automation that, I mean, retailers with 10 times the amount of people dedicated to email do not have.
Well, we're working really hard at it.
It sounds like it. So you know, you guys should feel very proud about where your email program is, even if there's tons of room for improvement.
Yeah.
You guys should feel really good about where you sit right now. So I just wanted to throw that out there and say that. Kevin, there's two things there, and I'll probably forget one of them. But Kevin, you mentioned lapsed purchase, 45 days. You figured out 45 days. So I don't know if I really have a question here, but I appreciate the fact that you said, hey, we looked at the data and we realized it's 45 days. There's going to be nuances there, but for the most part, and that's when we decided to trigger these things off of, and you were looking at purchase to purchase data. So that's one thing where a lot of retailers don't. They'll look at and say, oh, the industry best practice is 90 or 120 days, and they just kind of go from it. You guys are looking at data, and I think that's really cool because I'm presenting at Sweet World, and that's a big portion of one of my presentations is people don't look at this data, but they should be. So really no question, but I just want to say good job there. The other part was, I told you I forget. Cassidy, you said something I wanted to follow up on.
Trying to figure out how people use the product.
No, but that's interesting too.
Well, one thing that you did ask before about special things and surprising, interesting learnings that we've had. And one thing that's really surprised me is we brought that recipe plan on board. And I really felt like this was not a service, but a reason to get in front of people again, a way to make them use the product. I was surprised at how many people purchased from that recipe email. There's a couple links at the bottom for products that are used in the recipe, but it's primarily meant to, here's a great recipe inspiration for your week ahead. And I've just been surprised how much revenue we're driving through that seemingly content-oriented.
So that reminded me, you said what I want to tell you, it's actually something that Kevin said that led it and then you picked up on it was, we send this recipe email 8 days after. So I was going to ask the reason for, like, how'd you guys determine 8 days was a good time frame?
No good data.
We figured by that point somebody's gotten the package, generally speaking. Okay. Maybe they're starting to think about using it, unless, yeah. You know, we have a lot of different types of users. Some of them, they're buying one product once for a specific recipe. Others, they pretty much live on that product, so they buy it more frequently. So we felt like that was enough time for them to get it. And if they hadn't already started using it, maybe remind them why they might purchase it or give them a reason. Even if it's not the specific recipe they went for, as I built these, have picked like our top recipes, most beautiful pieces to inspire actually cooking and baking with these ingredients.
Because of that, I want to pivot to your content marketing strategy. This is something that you guys seem to be doing a good job of, is repurposing content like a traditional content marketer would. You try to repurpose content in a variety of different places to save on workload. And you start to see more and more retailers now, regardless of the products they sell, try to do content marketing, at least on the website, could be for SEO purposes. But very few of them will take that content and then turn it into an email, which I think to me is natural. It's one, it saves you time. You don't have to recreate the wheel every single time, but it's content you know, at least if you're looking at your analytics, you know that people like. You can look at, hey, which recipe is the most likes, whatever. So how do you guys view your content marketing strategy? Like, how do you guys look at that internally and say, do we do it to feed other things? Do we do it for SEO purposes? Or we do it for just so people keep coming back to the site for more things so we can stay top of mind so when they're standing in the grocery store, they recognize that brand name? How do you guys view your overall content marketing in terms of your overall strategy?
Well, I think it's something that we've evolved into. I'd say maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we were looking at rehauling our website in general. And we discovered that really, truly, most people were coming for recipes. Most people came to the site to get inspiration for the products. And that kind of delved us into looking at more recipe development internally. And at that same time is when we were starting to move more into influencer work and social space. So I think we're very content forward, so that we're looking at, here's a piece of content that either supports the brand, tells the brand story, inspires use of the product, or highlights a partner of ours. And where can we use that piece? It's very spoken wheel. Like, we're going to create this. We did a beautiful piece on stone milling and what that process looks like. And so we're going to make this pretty piece, and then we're going to feed it out on all these channels. And email is a supportive of that. The nice thing about email is very direct. You're one-on-one with somebody. I'm sending you an email. Here's this content. Go check it out. Whereas on the site, it's more passive and just hoping that somebody's going to click through to the right spot and find it. Obviously, social is the same way. As we put stuff out, getting people to click through to the site, whether, you know, like, we really approach it from those three prongs of, like, what is this trying to appeal to? And there's a lot of education to be done around the way we produce products, the type of products we produce, gluten-free eating. And so we use a lot of the pieces to support that and then feed it out onto the channels.
From a recipe standpoint, where do you guys get your recipes from?
We have an internal test kitchen that develops them. We have three bakers and cooks that work in there right now, pastry chef, as well as a nutritionist that works in there. They develop products because it's an ingredient-based company. The package needs to have an awesome recipe on it. So it started off there. They also do a lot of the product development within that test kitchen. And then on top of that, with my influencer work that we do, we partner with people, and whether we get a recipe from them to use or just feature the recipe, you know, because there's a difference between hosting it on the site and just posting it somewhere or in an email. So we've got those different sources.
People look to us to be an expert on our own products, obviously. So for us to post a recipe, it's going to be vetted and hopefully a good experience, like your lentils. So we get that from user feedback all the time that I love the recipe on the package. That is our pinnacle, great tested recipe. And it's amazing how many of our customers make what's on the package.
And when we started, it was things that Bob's wife was making in the kitchen that she just would put on the bag.
So I think to the point where you're surprised by how many people make the recipe that's on the bag. You know, I look at that probably goes to the point you were saying, Cassie, before, where people buy these things for all sorts of different reasons, some for a particular purpose, I'm making a cake and I want to use almond flour or whatever. But some they just buy for a couple cups or a cup and a half of something and they have this leftover. For me, if I have this leftover things, I always look at the pack just to see, oh, is there something there that interests me? So that makes a lot of sense. Do you guys happen to know offhand what a couple of your top recipes?
Oh, we have a flourless almond cake. We've changed the name a few times, but it's incredible, and people make it all the time because it serves so well for so many different diets. Plus, it's Passover friendly, and it's a very Easter feeling kind of recipe, springy, light. That's definitely one of the most popular.
The red lentils. It's
for basic directions.
My kids are gonna jump out the window of the car.
It's been the top organic hit for the last 2 months.
And I think some of that comes from people buying them in bulk bins, or they threw away the bag and don't know where to find the answer of how to make the thing. But until I started working at Bob's, I really didn't give any credit to package recipes. I just assumed it was, you know, whatever they thought I should make with that thing. But knowing how much we put into them, then I started baking more of them and trying, and they're really good.
There's always the Rice Krispie Treat recipe.
You can't go wrong with that.
So bad for it. It's so good.
But they're so good. They're so easy. That's what appeals.
Well, it's funny. They are super easy. And I think it was maybe the Super Bowl. I made some Rice Krispie treats. I'm like, yeah, the kids will eat them. And then I'll eat the other 75% that night. And what did I do? I don't think there was enough marshmallow in there or something. it solidified. So it was like bricks.
Oh, man. Yeah.
They were still good, but it would just crack and crumble. And
whenever I try to make them fancy and organic or vegan, that's what I always end up with. Tried and true, marshmallows, Rice Krispies.
So you mentioned before you guys work with influencers and you have this influencer strategies. You have some blog posts on there about like, hey, meet the influencer. How'd you guys get into the influencer market from just based on the products you sell? And, you know, how do you guys choose who's an influencer? Like this might be just ignorance on my part, but are there like recipe influencers out there?
Well, food influencers are definitely big players in this space. I think because food plays so well on social. We all enjoy looking at delicious food. It's kind of in our human nature to want to look at something that's going to taste good. And people got on very early. We first started working with influencers. It's hard to track now, but I want to say 9 or 10 years ago, as purely just joining the community. It started with, we would pick them up on Google Alerts. Somebody mentioned us, head over to the blog, leave a comment, and start a relationship there. And then we moved into more of like, oh, let me send you some product to play around with. And it's really evolved with the way Instagram has brought this surge of influencers. And it's really interesting and different. Some people seem like they're kind of getting into it, the game of making money as an influencer. So that's really what I spend a lot of my time doing, is building authentic relationships with the people who have influence. And I measure that through a lot of different tools. But at the end of the day, it gets down to my gut. And does this person seem authentic? Do they genuinely love the brand? Were they talking about us before we became involved with them? And then how do we build that natural fit of our brand into their content? And whether that's Instagram only, although, I mean, I really like blogs because they serve as that evergreen SEO place where that recipe continues to get traction year over year, and it stays forever, where an Instagram post is pretty ephemeral and will disappear. So, you know, we use a lot of different resources, but I have a real strong internal team of about 50 that I work with over and over again through the year, keeping that message top of mind with their followers.
I was going to ask about the organic blog posts that you guys write. Mm-hmm. Are you the one writing those?
I don't do it as much as I used to, but yes, I have a team of people that we work with, both internally and at our digital agency. They will do some SEO heavy pieces, and then we'll do the more fun pieces like highlighting an influencer and who they are and telling their story.
Do you guys have, like, generating the ideas for these? Is it pretty methodical now? You kind of know who's doing what, or are you still sourcing ideas for unique blog posts?
So we do a lot that is very SEO based. Like, we know what people are searching for, and you need that if you want your site to function well. So we definitely do that. And then we do a couple other avenues. And one is talking to our customer service team. What are people asking all the time? Are they hitting us up asking for how to make this, or why is this happening? Or I just don't understand the instructions. And then we create pieces that help answer those questions.
So that is something that a lot of retailers just don't do. There's this disconnect between customer service and whoever else. It could be sales, could be executive team, could be whatever. And I think that's a missed opportunity by most retailers. You guys are doing it. Stephanie Mason, who is presenting here, she was a past podcast guest from Balsam Hill, and they had a post-purchase series that was built on, they talked to their customer service, and they kept getting these high volume of calls about how to properly fluff these expensive artificial Christmas trees. And they're like, well, that should probably be a post-purchase series, right? And build that out. And it's been extremely effective for them. It cuts down the customer service calls. And, you know, it's something that a lot of retailers just, they don't do. They answer phones and they solve shipping issues.
Oh man, they're the front line for what's working and not working with your brand. And I think we've been lucky, because when I started in customer service there, and our director of marketing at that time, who's now our VP of marketing, worked right alongside customer service. So we were all really like physically located together. And social, you know, I know a lot of brands use it in different ways, but to me, it's always been a customer service tool. Mm-hmm. And it cuts down all of that time between your customer and you. And Bob has always been very big on having a real person answer the phone with real conversations. We don't do any of this tracking phone calls and times and how quick can you turn over a call. We give people the real attention that they want when they're going to call in or email.
And it's interesting. And it's in-house. It's not.
Oh, yeah. It's all internal.
It's only 40 feet from where we work today. So we haven't outsourced it. And it's an educated employee owner that's answering the phone.
There's still some tried and true things. As much as consumers want to change and how technology has maybe distracted them or challenged businesses because now product availability is so much more accelerated and it's everywhere, there's still these tried and true things about, I don't know, I use Twitter as a customer service tool.
Sure.
I use it for other reasons as well, but I use it for a customer service tool. And it always drives me crazy when I get the cut and paste answer back. And to your point, there's a lot of just value in having someone reach out or be able to communicate with you, whether it's calling your call center, sending an email, social media. Doesn't matter how old you are, you always want a real person to answer you and take care of you, because you feel, I don't know, you feel more valued at that point.
A bot can't turn an experience around and make that person a lifelong advocate. Like, a person can if you listen to them.
Right. I didn't see a lot of video on your website when I was bouncing around. Maybe I missed it, but obviously video comes with more challenges, right? You got to produce it, you got to edit it, you might have to hire outside firms to do it. So there's an expense that comes with it as well. But you can kind of shoot a video on a phone and turn something around. Do you guys have any plans to accelerate your video usage, or do you find that the written posts, they serve a great purpose?
Yeah, on social, we're very video heavy. And I think that's, our site is behind on that. But most of what we produce in video is, the goal is to get it for social. So we're cutting it, developing it, looking at what people are making to help ideate those recipes that we're going to show. We do mostly recipe videos. Kind of a mix of the hands and pans and a hosted video. And then we're cutting them for the different formats that need them, whether it's a horizontal for YouTube and Facebook or vertical for Instagram stories or Square. And then we're working right now on developing spots on the site to put those, because we have a pretty large library that we're not taking advantage of on the site.
We have the assets. We're just doing a poor job of serving them on a own site experience. And we're currently replatforming. So that is a top priority this coming year for us.
That's cool. I'm excited to see how that kind of plays out as things move along. So I'll definitely be staying on top. What's next for you guys, whether it's email marketing, types of lifecycle messages you guys are looking at, be like, oh, this year I want to do this type of thing, or from a content perspective, right? Replatforming, it takes a lot of effort and time. I'm sure Kevin's going to be quite busy with that. But
we spoke earlier, the cart abandonment is a new Bronto feature that we signed on just this last year. So we're going to get that fully up and running. Our customers are very passionate, and half of them, you know, just buy our product, but the other half of them are real advocates for us. So we have tied in the user generated content into the emails.
Cool.
So we have a direct feed. If someone just gives an awesome testimonial on this product, we tie that into the email as a, we saw you look at this product, name from city, bought it for this reason. So we're tying that in. We're going to tie it in more so.
I'm on this huge social proof kick right now. I mentioned this presentation where I'm talking about the lapsed purchase thing. I've got a huge section of social proof in there as well. So
we are very lucky that we've got very dedicated fans. They spend the time of their day to respond to an email, and they write between 20 in words and six paragraphs of the reason why they appreciate buying from us. So we utilize that whenever we can, and we're going to continue to push that in more and more spots within email and elsewhere.
So you guys are doing, you're doing content, you're writing blogs, you have an influencer strategy, you have social media as an outreach channel. You guys are implementing and have goals to implement lifecycle messages throughout the course of the year. You're looking at ways to bring, tie those things together, whether it's social content into the email side. Someone listening, and I mentioned before, you guys are doing kind of a bang up job with these things, especially for two on the digital team here. If someone is feeling either challenged with how to start a more robust strategy, whether it's email, whether it's content, whether it's marrying these two, what would each of your one piece of advice be? And that could be specific to kind of what you do on a day-to-day basis. Take email, for example. I know I need to do lifecycle messages, but I don't. Like, what's your one piece of advice to start that process?
My answer is tackle one project at a time. From no welcome series to welcome series is huge. You communicate, and digital is great because you can look at the return on investment. You can see first week of it, you're not going to get anything, but it's kind of a set it and forget it and be able to reuse it. That's the great part at Bob's. The difference between batch and blast, you know, oh, this sale's kicking off, to teach people to say, yes, we're only going to write people who have spent X and lapsed this much. We don't know when this is going to send specifically, but we know it's going to happen. It's going to continue happening. So you get the development work, the graphic artist time gets to be reused for 3 years and running, and it's trackable, and you will see a very positive ROI. And then once you're done with that, move on to the next. Do a robust shipping confirmation email and do a robust birthday email, and the results will be there.
Yeah, truly, I'd say the same thing. And I think that's part of why we work so well together. And if you had to pick just one automation to start with, I mean, I think it just makes sense to make that first touch welcome email really personal to them. Focus on that, get it up and running, and then move on to the next one.
Yeah, I think that's a challenge for a lot of companies, or just a marketer who's doing the work, is they might go to a conference or they read a Bronto blog or something, like, oh, I should be doing these five different things. And they start laying them out and they get 10% of five things done.
Sure.
Right? And then you're in the same place you were before you started. So I like the approach of being able to focus on what you're doing, get it done. I think there's a benefit of if you have multiple, and I'm going to plug my computer in here so it doesn't die, so I apologize. If you have multiple messages or series as well, is you could do the first message and automate it and then just kind of build on as you go as well. Anything I neglected to ask you guys today that you think would be important for the marketer to know?
Well, I guess looking at your whole strategy and making it cohesive so that wherever that touch point is, whether it is on email or on your site or on social or in the store, that it all fits together and it tells the same story. I know we struggled with that for a long time and now have gotten into a good, pretty good place that wherever you find Bob's products, that feeling of the same family vibe is going to translate.
So you said you struggled with that for a while. How did you figure out, hey, we need to hone in on this thing?
I think it just took great direction from leadership of stopping, taking a look. Let's look at where we're going with this. First, we need to know who we are. What message is that we want out there? And if it's something that evolves, depending on what we're doing, where we want to go, like we just launched a whole line of ready-to-eat bars. That's a whole different ball game for us. We've never worked in the ready-to-eat space. So making sure that as we developed that messaging, it still lined up with who we were as a company. I think that's one of the most powerful things a company can do is have a solid mission and a good identity of who they are so that everything supports that. If you can measure back to your mission, then everybody can do work that's...
Great advice. Do you guys have a favorite restaurant in the Portland area?
There's so much good food there. I have to say Departure is a really fabulous dining experience because you can get to see the whole city from where you're dining, and they have a great, they have a wonderful sushi menu. I'm not sure what else they have. It's fabulous, though.
The Whole Grain Store, Bob's Red Mill.
You can't say that.
What?
That can't be your choice.
No, I like the food cart scene.
Okay.
And that's...
Oh, man.
That's true.
Endless choices there.
Yeah, they... about two blocks from where we work, they roll in twice a week, a great smattering of every ethnic food, and it's $8 and you get great food almost every time. So
awesome.
Very cool.
Do you guys consider a hot dog a sandwich?
No.
Well, it depends on your definition. I've listened to it a lot, and there are technically two pieces of bread, kind of. It's one piece of bread and a filling, so it kind of would be like a sandwich. So I'll say yes.
And why not for you?
It's a hot dog. It's a different thing. Is a hamburger a sandwich? No, it's a hamburger.
No, it's bread and a filling.
But yeah, it depends on your definition. Is this like a real debate?
Absolutely.
I know that the guy on the Sporkful has some strong feelings about it.
So am I being provocative when I say no?
No, I don't think there's a wrong answer. It's a good question.
Do you guys consider Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Well, it's always on at Christmas, so yes.
It is.
Much like Harry Potter has also become a Christmas movie.
So what was the answer there, Cassidy?
Yes.
I still say no, man. We are just at odds.
But we work really well together. We make a good team.
Remember that time they used to work really well together? All right. I got to get you guys out of here in a couple minutes so you can make that game, because I kept you over time, so I appreciate that. If you guys could have one meal for the rest of your life, what would you choose?
Is it like the exact same food? Like exactly the same? Or like genre of food?
Yeah, it'd have to be more type of food, yeah.
Sushi.
Sushi?
It could be wide variety.
Okay, that's good.
Tacos.
I would go with tacos. All right, last one. Do you guys have any guilty pleasures? Could be music, TV shows.
I don't know if it's a guilty pleasure. I like a good Pacific Northwest IPA.
I don't think there's anything to feel guilty about there.
What's your favorite one?
Oh, gosh. On tap, Boneyard. Boneyard IPA. Okay. They only keg it. So you can only get it in bars. It's out of Bend, Oregon.
Very cool. They have beer at the NetSuite reception there. They have a Sculpin beer. And I usually ask my guests, name as many fish as you can in 15 seconds. And Bill Connolly from Olapik was on. And he came right out of the gate. He goes, Sculpin. And I go, what the hell is a Sculpin, right? And he's like, he goes, I think it's a fish, but I saw it on a beer bottle.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh.
It's an ugly, very cool looking fish.
All their beers are nautical.
If you don't know, you should Google that after this episode is over.
After you Google Bob's Red Mill.
Yeah. You're repping them harder than us.
All right, how about your guilty pleasure?
I don't know how guilty I feel about it, but I'm still a huge Simpsons fan all these years later. I still watch the new ones, even if they're not super good anymore.
I gave up a couple years ago.
Well, it's a little known fact that a lot of that stuff is inspired by Portland, Oregon, because Matt Groening lived there, grew up there, so... It's always fun to see those signs that have the same name as like Skidmore.
Didn't they officially say
that? Well, Springfield's not in Oregon, no.
Correct. Yeah, that was like
but a lot of the names, anyways.
I have Apple TV and FX, or FX Now, whatever they call it. You can get every Simpsons episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
But about 3 years ago, they played every Simpsons episode on FX, and I DVR'd every single Simpsons episode. And I watch one about every 4 months. And there's still like 250 some. So my wife's always like, can you just delete those things? I'm like, no, I'm still watching. Like every, and she's listening. Every now and then I might go in there and just delete an episode just to make it look like I'm watching them. I'll get to them one day.
Did they play them straight through?
Yeah.
What? That's incredible.
Well, I think they're in like 32 years now or something.
Yeah, it took like 5 or 6 days. It was nuts, but it was nonstop.
It's good stuff.
Absolutely. You guys have any questions for me today?
How do you like working for Bronto?
It's great. 7.5 years so far.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I'm slowly ranking up from like tenured employee side.
I was really sad to see the move away from the little dinosaur on the favorites bar. When you save it, now it's a B for Bronto.
Not mine, assist.
I love brontosauruses. I have the big one at home.
Really,
I have the medium-sized one at home.
It was a great mascot for a while. Very recognizable. People love them. You go everywhere, and they're like, "Oh, I love the dinosaurs." You know, the pictures and everything. And
you have the inflatable ones here at this conference. I haven't seen any.
I don't think so, but I wasn't in charge of like packing the stuff. But we're still a good company, so.
You're a great company. We're always so happy with the support that we get when we need it.
Your bottle koozie from last year, you had those.
Yeah.
Those are fun.
Oh, yeah, I have one of those.
Yep.
There's always good swag.
Yeah. Always good.
Did you guys get one of those travel, they look like pens, but they're screwdrivers?
Oh, no.
I don't know if we have them here, but I got one, I don't know, 6-8 months ago.
Like glass repair kit? Like eyeglasses.
Yes. Yeah, I'll pull it out after. But it's like a screwdriver, and it looks like a pen, but you unscrew the top, and it's got Phillips and flathead things
awesome.
In there, and you just kind of snap it in. But it's TSA approved as well.
Nice.
I don't know what a TSA unapproved screwdriver looks like, but
it's a good point.
But no, it's been a good ride so far.
Good.
So I'm rocking and rolling still. Good question. Any other questions?
I don't have any.
Well, thanks for coming, guys. I appreciate it. We'll have info in the episode description on. At least Bob's Red Mill, but how to contact you guys if you're okay with that.
Absolutely.
If people want to reach out, what's the best way for them to reach out? Is it email, LinkedIn, Twitter? You know, how do you guys prefer?
Email works great, but any of the social channels you can get through to us pretty easily. We monitor them all.
Yeah. Email, LinkedIn. Yeah.
Yep.
Sounds good. So we'll have that in the episode description. Cassidy Stockton, Kevin Irish from Bob's Red Mill, everyone. Cassidy, Kevin, thanks for your time again. To those listening, especially our listener of the week, Jim from New Orleans, so Nola in the house. If you want to be the listener of the week, let me know you've tuned in. And if you're interested in telling your e-commerce or email marketing story, I'd love to hear from you as well. Until next time, have a great day and be kind to one another.